Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 142 for November 17th, 2010. CentOS. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, bringing to you each week the interesting projects, the not-so-heard-of projects, sometimes the really well-heard-of projects like today's show. But before I get into today's show, let's go ahead and bring on my co-host. Once again, all the way from good old UK somewhere, good old Dan Lynch. Hey, Dan. Welcome to the show again.
Hey, how you doing? It's good to be back.
And where actually are you? You're somewhere in the UK, right?
I'm in Merseyside, yeah, up in Liverpool, which I'm sure, I suppose most people would recognize as being the home of the Beatles. So I'm up north in England.
Okay, well, that's good enough. And you speak English, which is nice. I am, once again, on the don't have to translate in this show, although some of your phrases, your lucky phrases like chip chip and Imperio and whatever, all these like that, right?
That's right. I've left my bowler hat somewhere today, I'm afraid.
Okay.
And my cane.
For those watching the video, I'm on the 43rd floor of the 9th tallest building in LA, working for my client here, who so graciously gives me both a little bit of office space so I can tape the show on Wednesday mornings, and also pays me, which is really nice. Not for now, but I mean, later they'll be paying me for it later in the day. So let's talk about today's guest. This is a really interesting project, and in fact, probably a lot more significant than most people realize. We're going to talk about CentOS, which is the open source, the free version of the Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Now, normally Red Hat is what a lot of large organizations use commercially to power their sites. When I was working for one of my clients back recently, they had Red Hat on thousands of machines. And the reason they have Red Hat Enterprise Linux on the thousands of machines is they want to be able to call somebody up in the middle of the night and say, something's broken, it needs to be fixed. And so they pay large amounts of money for that. Now, that also means that Red Hat Enterprise Linux is really good for large organizations. And so what CentOS does is they take the sources that Red Hat has to make available to the community, and they compile them and support them using community-based support rather than centralized support like Red Hat is charging for. And so we have on our show today, we have KB Singh, who is one of the lead developers for the CentOS project. And we're going to talk to him about how CentOS works and why you would choose it instead of Red Hat or in addition to, and all sorts of things like that. Does that sound like a fair assessment, Dan?
Yeah, it sounds great. I've been running CentOS on my own web server for about 4 years, so I can't wait to hear more about it and really get into the details.
Very good. Well, I don't think I have anything else I want to talk about before we get to the guest, so let's go ahead and bring our guest on.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Going well. I'm glad to have you on the show today, and I kind of gave sort of the high-level view of what CentOS is all about at the beginning of the show, but I probably mucked it up a little bit, not being a direct Linux user myself, so why don't you sort of give us the top-level view of what CentOS is all about?
So it's quite a long story, but in a short one-minute sort of a setup, what happened was that a few years back, Red Hat decided to change their Linux strategy, their enterprise Linux strategy, and they brought in a subscription model for the product that they were going to support. But what they also did was they left the sources for that product available to the public should anybody want to use it. What CentOS does is we take those sources and we build a distribution with the sources to be as close to the Red Hat offering as possible, as binary compatible, as ABI compliant, as API compliant, with the only difference being that things look different because there's no Red Hat branding in it and you don't get any support. So you basically use CentOS if you can support yourself or if you have an alternative support model or an alternative, you know, support provider for you. That's basically in a nutshell what it is. It's a Linux distribution built off the sources provided by Red Hat Linux, and it's completely binary compatible with RHEL.
Okay, well, let's actually back up a little bit, though. Where did Red Hat come from? And are they probably like the most popular version of Linux out there?
At the moment, yes. Red Hat is pretty much the largest Linux vendor, especially in the business and the enterprise user areas. Ubuntu is, of course, picking up a lot of traction in the home user, you know, personal computer seller side of things. But Red Hat is still the largest enterprise vendor for Linux.
And Ubuntu is based on Debian. And how does Debian and Red Hat's Linux compare?
Debian is pretty much built by a community of providers. There's no real support model behind it. There's no real business driving it forward. It's built by the community for the community, which is completely volunteer driven. Whereas Red Hat comes from more of a corporate background. You know, they have a product, they have a product model they work towards. They put it out there. They sell support for it. And that's the primary difference between the two. In terms of actual user density, rumor has it that they have about an even split. Although these sort of things, you know, especially in the open source world, you can't really tell because there's no way of measuring how many, you know, people are using your systems out there. And most of the big vendors never really report how many machines they have running Linux anyway.
Now, in terms of distributions, they're both running pretty much the same Linux kernel, right? Because that comes from Linus Torvalds and his group. And then he sends it out, makes available to both the Debian community and the Red Hat community, Red Hat company, actually, I should say. And then who then decides what else gets put with it? It's mostly the GNU tools or in the core distribution and so on, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the Linux kernel that's out there is the same that everybody's using. In the case of Red Hat, though, they do a lot of batching. They have a lot of developers sitting in-house who will add a lot of functionality from their own end. They'll add a lot of compatibility stuff for the other user land tools available as well. But it's basically the Linux kernel with the GNU tools and whatever applications people would be running on them.
Okay.
Cool. Now, KB, something that interests a lot of people is you mentioned Red Hat and CentOS, obviously. It's the relationship between the two, because a lot of people would immediately look at that and think, well, Red Hat can't be very happy with CentOS repackaging their product. So how does the relationship work? Is it a good working relationship that you have?
I think that's a good question. The perspective varies depending on who you speak to. From our end, from the CentOS end, we think we have a very good relationship with Red Hat in that we don't actually have a direct relationship with Red Hat. The components that we are consuming, Red Hat are putting out and making available to anybody and everybody. So it could be CentOS, it could be, you know, Joe Blogs, it could be anybody. From the Red Hat side of things, it gets slightly more interesting because I feel, and this is completely my personal opinion, of course, it's not Red Hat opinion, but I feel that Red Hat Engineering and Red Hat Technical are quite happy with what we're doing, because it's not really a one-way street. We take the sources and build a distribution around it, build a platform around it. But what we also do is we file a lot of feature requests, we file patches, we file bug reports. We work with some of their engineering teams to try and solve problems that users are having out in the open. So we feel that those guys are happy with us. Now, if you shift the focus a little bit and go across to Red Hat marketing and Red Hat sales, they're not really that happy with what's going on with CentOS. But I like one thing, one message I always like to get across to them is that, look, if there's X number of users who are using CentOS today, that's X number of users who are using the Red Hat platform. And that's X number of users who are not using SUSE or Ubuntu.
Right. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Something I was also interested in is you mentioned briefly there about you're submitting bugs against their kind of code base, if you like. So do you work upstream? Do you get bugs submitted that you can then push up to Red Hat and be dealt with by them?
We do. And we try and do it as aggressively as possible. If anybody was to report issues to us, we always try and liaison with the Red Hat guys to see if it's an issue which comes down the stream from them or it's something that we've induced on our side. And we have a fairly active QA team as well, which is always proactively looking at issues coming up and handling all of the bug reports and issue reports coming up. In a lot of cases, we've had situations where the CentOS user base actually comes from a different sort of a user base than what the Red Hat's paying customers do. And sometimes we have users reporting issues to us that Red Hat hasn't been able to find in their own regular testing. And what we also try and do is every time we file an issue or a complaint or a support request, we always try and follow it up with a patch if we can, because, you know, that sort of indicates our goodwill as well, that we're not just, it's not just a one-way street. We're helping them build a better product as well.
So in many ways, it's making a larger testing base for them and getting more bug reports and stuff like that. So you mentioned that CentOS users may differ a little bit from the traditional kind of Red Hat Enterprise users. Can you fill us in a little bit on that? How would you say CentOS users differ?
I think if you go back to the grassroots of why CentOS was created and how we all got together as a group of people, it's easy to see how the user base sort of diverged a little bit. When Red Hat went down the route of creating the RHEL product base, they went in for a subscription model. And with the subscription model, you got a product which they would support. Now, if there was anything that you wanted to do on that platform would change the product, for example, use a different kernel or run it in an environment that Red Hat doesn't officially endorse or use hardware against that machine which is not ratified by Red Hat first, there would be a lot of support issues and Red Hat would not be very keen on supporting those platforms initially. And which is the reason why we got together to create a platform where people could sort of, you know, figuratively shoot themselves using, you know, whatever instrument they want in whichever, you know, limb they want to. And there's no support, no guarantees. It's a best effort. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, we saw that there were certain industries that came up which sort of adopted CentOS initially quite a bit, like the hosting business, because they do some pretty crazy stuff. If you look at some of the intensive hosting solutions out there, they do some pretty crazy stuff with the platform. And it would be hard for Red Hat to support, you know, 4,000 people who do 4,000 different things to the same platform. Whereas here, because there's no guarantees, there's no support venues that you can sort of go to, there's no phone number you can call at 8 o'clock at night or, you know, 3 in the morning, all bets are off. So if you want to do whatever you want to do, feel free to do so.
Hmm. Now, that brings up an interesting point, actually, because I was looking at some reports recently that that list CentOS as the most popular of the Linux distributions being used on web hosts, just from some basic tests and things and surveys that have been run. So what do you think makes you so popular in the web server market? Is that something that you aim for, or do you do anything special towards that end?
I think the grassroots, the base for what really helped CentOS get traction in the hosting business is from what I was mentioning earlier, that if you have five different hosting companies, each one of them is going to change the platform in five different ways. Mm. And then if you multiply that to 100, to 1,000, to 10,000, to 40,000, it's easy to see how that's going to become a support nightmare. Also, the hosting business is very competitive, especially on the price front. And if somebody has to pay like, you know, $60 or $50 a month towards platform costs, they're going to think twice about it. What they got with CentOS was a common base that a lot of people were using. It came with the guarantee that we will make our best efforts to make sure it stays compatible with Red Hat. So certification on the Red Hat platform is sort of inherited down to CentOS. It's not, I mean, we don't certify anybody, but, you know, the certification becomes inherited. And we just found that the hosting business was very keen on taking that up. Also, what we did in 2005, 2006 was that we made a conscious effort of reaching out to the hosting companies to say that, look, here's a platform that you can use. And we think it's a good fit for the hosting business. And what can we change and how can we change it? We got some good feedback. We got some negative feedback. We've made changes on our side. And we've got some good results out of it.
Mm. Cool. So it is something that you kind of actively work on and approaching the hosting company. That's really interesting. Something that I was actually talking to some of the Red Hat support guys about when I met some of them a while ago in Germany. They were saying that, because I've been intrigued by this kind of relationship between CentOS and Red Hat, and they seemed really positive about CentOS. And what they actually said to me was that if you're on if a customer comes to them with a CentOS platform, you know, installation, and says they'd like to buy a Red Hat support contract, that it's actually very easy for them to do that and then almost upgrade them or whatever to CentOS. So is there anything that you do to make that easier, or is that something that you see a lot as a use case?
We do, in that the core distribution is kept as close to the upstream Red Hat product as possible. We don't try and change anything that we don't have to. We try and keep all the binary compatibility, so all apps would work exactly the same. We try and retain all tooling on the platform as well. So, you know, if somebody wanted to switch from CentOS to Red Hat, they would not really have any major problem. Red Hat would know that this is a platform that, you know, represents the same code base that they are selling to people. So the migrations would become easy. Apart from that, there's been, you know, anecdotal evidence that, you know, somebody's got 500 machines and he's running CentOS on 100 of them and he's running Red Hat on the other 400 of them. And, you know, if they've ever had a problem 3 o'clock in the morning on any of the machines, they've been able to call Red Hat and get support for it. I suppose that's good for the customers.
Yeah, it sounds good. So in that case, they just don't tell them that it's CentOS then, I presume. That's quite interesting. Is it possible to go the other way? I mean, I'm imagining that's something that Red Hat probably wouldn't want to encourage so much, is people maybe feeling that they can't afford their Red Hat support contract and they want to fall back to, or they want to change to CentOS. Is it possible to do that as well?
Oh yes, I mean we have people coming across, you know, every few days saying that, you know, they had Red Hat licenses and they're now switching over to CentOS. But we also see people doing that for periods of times, like, you know, for 6 months, 8 months, a year, and then actually going back to an RHEL subscription, or then coming back to CentOS as well. One of the things, I suppose, what we do is that we document the process that somebody could adopt to migrate from RHEL to CentOS, and we try and make it as painless and as easy as possible.
So you can do that without breaking your install, if you like. If I've got a, you know, a web farm or something with a lot of machines running a website, obviously I don't want to lose it, get any downtime. So I can do that seamlessly, fairly easily.
From RHEL to CentOS, you can. From CentOS to RHEL, I believe, and this is again based on, you know, what people have said on IRC or on email, is that the Red Hat engineers insist on a certain few packages being replaced physically, like the kernel and glibc. And things like that, you know, because they want to make sure it's absolutely the same code that they're maintaining. But if you want to switch from RHEL to CentOS, it's literally a case of changing three packages on your machine. 5 minutes later, you're on CentOS and you get all your security updates, all your bug fixes. And you're off.
Yeah. That sounds really cool. I mean, it sounds incredibly easy. I was just wondering, you mentioned packaging and so on. Obviously, you try and keep compatibility with the Red Hat package base. So does that mean I could install Red Hat packages? Do you need to repackage them in some way for CentOS?
Oh, no. It's completely binary compatible. So not only can you take an open source package, you can take a commercial vendor's provided package. You could even take, appliance provider's packages. And if they're certified to work with RHEL, they will almost certainly work with CentOS. If there is a case where that doesn't happen, we always expect users to report to us, you know, that something isn't working, and we'll always be very proactive in making sure we fix those problems. Because one of the core selling points of CentOS to the community base is that tooling available for RHEL, development being done on RHEL, will just work for you on CentOS out of the box without a problem.
So something that I found interesting is that obviously Red Hat themselves have Fedora, which is their which is their, you know, community release, if you like. So do you find that any situations where the Red Hat people would encourage someone to go to Fedora rather than CentOS? So what's the difference there?
I'm sure they would. The big difference between Fedora and Red Hat is that the Fedora user base is very developer oriented. They aren't so much of, you know, a consumer side of things. There isn't very much of enterprise or business representation in the Fedora user bases and even in the Fedora contributors. So what tends to happen is that Fedora tends to track, you know, the latest, the bleeding edge, if you want to call it, you know, the latest, the greatest features, you know, all the whiz bang, the display issues, you know, things like the latest graphics card and stuff like that. Whereas RHEL focuses more on having a product that is sustainable over a period of time. So if you install, for example, you know, you install a blog on your website and you install it in 2007, you don't want to be in a situation where every 6 months you're reinstalling your machine and having to do the whole thing again and again and again. And that is kind of like how the Fedora ecosystem works. Whereas with RHEL and then with CentOS as well, you install a machine in 2007, you know, you're going to get 7 years to 8 years of continued bug fix and security support without any problems, without any issues, knowing that the application that you've deployed today is going to carry on working for you for, you know, 7 to 8 years.
Yeah, well, obviously in the web server market, that's a huge thing. Nobody wants to reinstall every 6 months. So just a last quick question on the whole relationship with Red Hat and CentOS. I promise I won't bang on about this all the way through. But I was actually talking to Max Spivak and Paul Frields from the Fedora project a little while ago, and they were telling me that Red Hat actually tried to make it easier for you guys by putting all their branding that they use, which obviously you have to remove, into one package or into an easy number of packages for you to remove. Is that true? And is there anything else that they do to kind of make it easier for you?
That would be good if they did.
Okay.
It's good to hear that they've done that. I think What happens is that legal requirements dictate that we replace all Red Hat logos and we replace their name at a couple of places. But what we try and do is we try and go at least two steps further. The first step that we try and address, and we're very, very, very careful that we do, is that we remove any indications from any of the packages or any of the software that might confuse the user into believing he's on a Red Hat platform. So It may not be logos, it may not be branding, it could be something else completely, completely different, like what compiler was used, whether it was a Red Hat compiler or not. You know, things like Firefox, when you look at the about box in Firefox to see what build you're using or what version you're using, we make sure we indicate to the user that he is actually on CentOS, because we don't want to get into a situation where third parties may, be able to create a thing where they say that they're actually selling an RHEL platform where they actually go out and ship a CentOS platform instead. The second thing that we try and do is we make sure that there is no connection between CentOS and the machines running CentOS and any other Red Hat services. I don't know if you've used RHEL, you'll notice that if there's a bug, you're normally advised to go and file a bug report at bugzilla.redhat.com. So we make sure we replace those with, appropriate URLs which point to CentOS instead. Similarly, if you want to update a machine on RHEL, you would use a service called the Red Hat Network, which is a web interface that you can go to. You can manage all your machines, you can do your updates from there. Now, CentOS doesn't have that. So what we are very careful in doing is we remove all mentions of RHEL, and we make sure that the CentOS machines don't ship in a way, rather the CentOS distribution doesn't ship set up in a way that it would try and connect to the Red Hat Network. Of course, legally, what Max is probably pushing down from your end is all that's required. But we try and go a little further to make sure that we create more of a CentOS based ecosystem rather than try and have Red Hat have to pick up the burden of 10,000 guys installed CentOS today and they have 10,000 support requests coming from people.
One of the things that I found interesting in listening to this conversation so far is the origins of Linux were really about being able to have, my own operating system on my own machine and then share it with others sort of in a developer environment to basically tinker with it. But it was, from what I followed in the history, Red Hat really was sort of the first ones to really step up and say, we're going to make this industrial grade, ready to run, ready for, commercial operations to build their infrastructure out on. And I'm really excited to hear that your group with CentOS is able to then get that back in the open source community in the sense that you don't have to have, paying license fees and subscription fees to Red Hat to take care of that. One of the things I'm curious about, though, is like how far do you have to lag to sort of be the same as Red Hat, but you're constantly catching up, right?
That's true. So if Red Hat puts out a package today, we basically commit to trying to get it out there within 24 hours. If it's a major version or if a major release coming out, then it takes a bit longer. It could be a couple of weeks. But once you have an installed product, once you have an installed distribution with CentOS, updates usually don't lag more than maybe a day or a day and a half.
Wow, that's I was expecting an answer on the order of 2 or 3 months, but that's darn impressive. How do you do that? What's your community size? How many people are actually working alongside you for this?
You'd be surprised, the number is really small. I would probably say the number does not make it into double digits in terms of people contributing towards the build and running the distribution. But there is a very large community of people, probably in the hundreds, who help with resources, who help with things like handling bug reports, looking at issues, helping out in the communities, doing user support, and things like that. I mean, it's always hard to put a number on that. But people who are doing the builds and running the distribution from the admin side of things, it's definitely less than 10.
Wow, and what's your funding model? Is this a labor of love for all of you, or is there some money behind it somewhere? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a good question. There is no money. We don't get paid to do any of this work. All of us who are contributing into CentOS are doing so because either we have another use for it, as in we use it at work, or we people who are doing this kind of a thing because it's something that we want to do. I think at this point, kind of sort of directly related to your question, I think one point which is worth highlighting here is that when CentOS came together as a distribution, when we came together as a project, one thing happened which was surprising, and one thing which in retrospect I now realize is very different from a lot of other projects, and that is that the contributors mostly represented the user base rather than the developer base. Mm. So people who came together were guys who were actually consuming the product, and therefore a lot of the processes that got put in a way that would be conducive to furthering the user requirements rather than, you know, a developer, should we say, an estimation of user requirements.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite impressive then, because that means that it's really going to be more useful then, because it's the people using it that are saying, here's how we want to use it.
That's true. That's true. I mean, that is definitely a big advantage, because, you know, there is Linux is obviously big within the technical markets, you know, unlike, let's say, Windows or Mac OS, which tends to be more of, you know, end user markets. So you expect people using Linux to already be, you know, capable of doing things like, you know, looking at the hardware, being able to do some sort of diagnostic bug reports. Now, what happens is that CentOS, because of the demographic it was targeting at the time, which was system administrators in businesses and enterprises, the people who came together were people who had, you know, an appreciation for things like high-level automation, a lot of automated testing, you know, being able to make sure that what goes out is really worth consuming on our own machines. So, you know, we'd want to make sure that security is a big deal. We want to make sure that bug reports are a big deal, because these are things which affect our machines, you know, in some cases our own personal machines, in some cases our business machines or our work machines. And those sort of inputs right through the years have made a fantastic difference to what we're doing and how we do what we do. In that, I can tell you now that if there is a build or if it's a package that needs to be taken from source code and needs to be built and then converted into a component which is shipped out to end users, the entire process from one end to the other end is automated. There's nobody who's required to actually push any buttons. There is nobody who's required to actually do anything to make that build happen. And we do builds and things like, we do triple builds. Every package is built, you know, three times. We test everything three times. We test it on different machines, on different infrastructure, to make sure that what's going out is really something that we would trust on our own machines.
That's an amazing amount of commitment from some volunteers for Labor of Love for you there. I was just going to comment that actually of the last six or seven clients that I've had, I think only two of them have been on Red Hat, and the others have all been on CentOS. So whatever you're doing, it's working right and getting accepted by large organizations. Is there any special marketing that you're doing to these organizations to find out about CentOS when they have Red Hat as an alternative?
Actually, no. We have our promo team is purely and totally focused on addressing only open source events. As a matter of policy, unless we have a big issue with a particular vendor, we don't go to things like conferences, we don't go to vendor expos. We only promote ourselves to people who are within, you know, sort of like the same peer groups as such. One of the reasons why I feel CentOS has done very well, especially in the business markets, is that a lot of the emerging technologies which are coming up now, things like, you know, you hear the term DevOps, you'd hear things like, you know, configuration management. You'd hear about things like Ruby on Rails, things like virtualization and Xen. You'd be surprised how many of these technologies were actually developed on CentOS and were brought to market on CentOS, which really helped us in a way that businesses were happier to take on the fact that CentOS is perhaps a trustable platform.
Wow. And have you been with the project since the beginning, or did you come on somewhere in the middle, if I read that right?
I came on about maybe 6 months or so after the project initially started off. I went down the route of, you know, putting my money on a different project called White Box Linux. And that project was basically run by one person when he had the time to do what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it. And that wasn't going to scale very far. So along came CentOS, and CentOS looked to have a better business model and looked to have a better model, as in, you know, we could get involved, we could do things, there was infrastructure available, people were ready to accept help. And that was 2005, and then I'm here now, still here.
Very good. Sounds like you're sticking with it as well. Back to just the funding question again, who pays for the like the servers and stuff and the network bandwidth and that kind of stuff?
Initially, in the first couple of months, we tried to get to a situation where we bought a few machines. Mm-hmm. And we tried to pay for our bandwidth on our own. And then when CentOS 3.3 was released, you know, there was this thing that, hey, if 100 guys use this product, we'll be really happy. and about 10,000 people downloaded it, which caused a few issues. And we again then went back and we started talking to people who were using it, things like hosting companies, things like, you know, enterprises who had a lot of bandwidth. And we started asking them for donations. And within about 6 months to a year, we were able to get into a situation where we basically were running completely off donated hardware. Today we have about 120 machines in about 80 different data centers. They all donated to us. We have a couple of terabytes per second worth of bandwidth, which is completely donated to the project. Mm-hmm. And we have no bills.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. And as I was studying up for this show, I noticed an interesting paragraph on the wiki page about CentOS, and that's it referred to a guy named Lance Davis. If you don't mind talking about that, about what happened there and maybe as a warning to other organizations that are in similar places, what CentOS is?
Sure. I mean, Lance was one of the first guys to get involved with the CentOS project. And because of what he was doing and how he was doing it, he took on the role of administrating the project and looking into things like advertising revenues and looking into things like, you know, owning the host name and making sure that things get, you know, organized in a proper way. And that worked fine. That worked fine for a long time. And then it came to a time when, as it does with most people who are doing it on a completely contributory kind of a basis, you have, you know, personal issues. You have, you know, your son who needs to, you know, spend time with you. You need to do certain things. You have commitments. You know, you need to make sure that you pay your bills. You know, your wife needs her things sorted out as well. You know, that business of running the house has to be looked into as well. We just started going down into a situation where Lance was, you know, more and more and more difficult to get hold of, and he just did not have the time and resources to contribute back to the project. Coming up to a point where it became quite critical because the CentOS domains were coming up for renewal and we weren't able to get hold of him. There were outstanding issues on, you know, admin agenda, which had been around for like 6 months, 8 months, and we still couldn't get hold of him. And that basically came to head when the rest of the core team had to basically put an open letter out there saying, look, Lance, we need to speak to you. We need to get these things organized. There are hundreds and thousands of people who've put their trust in us as a project to do the right thing. And we feel at this moment in time, you're not really the right person to be doing this because of whatever resource constraints, personal time, you know, personal issues that he had or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that we look back and see how we got into a situation like this. I think, like I was telling you earlier, a lot of the people who got involved with the early days of CentOS were people who had not been involved with a lot of open source projects for many, many, many years. So it was all a learning experience for many of us. There were a couple of guys who had experience, but again, they were people who had, you know, resource issues or time constraints. And we just let these things slide. And even important things like, you know, making sure that we get a CentOS foundation in place, making sure that the project does not become about one person or two people or 10 people. The project should be set up in a way that it can continue beyond individual, you know, resource commitments. Getting all of those things in order is something that I think every project should look at.
And it's especially something the size of CentOS. I mean, if you have this many people using it, you really ought to have some sort of centralized bank account and centralized ownership of domain names, things like that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't at this moment in time have any funding going through. So the bank account issue is not that big a deal at the moment, but it's something we'd like to change. You know, and it's not a question of that I want to make, you know, X amount of money or the other contributors want to get paid for the time. There are lots of people who are contributing the time against, you know, no financial gain. But there are other issues that come up, things like ensuring that CentOS always has a build system. CentOS always has a website that we can sustain. CentOS can, you know, pay for maybe getting a couple of designers to sort out our website. Things like that, you know, we need to get money through for that. And we just feel that we need to get the foundation in place now. And we need to get, you know, like you said, the bank accounts in place, get the trademark sorted out, things like that. But I think like probably every open source project will tell you it's always tricky working out when you're large enough to do this kind of a thing. For us, many of the size things came as a surprise. You know, last year in May, a couple of us sat down to see if we could work out, perhaps, you know, estimate how many people may be using CentOS. Mm. And I remember in our private channel, we all had bets going, you know, somebody had, I'll buy drinks if we can make it to, you know, 500,000. Somebody said 700,000. When we actually did an audit of just the IP addresses hitting our CentOS mirrors, we clocked in over 2.5 million unique IPs. There were a lot of people who fell off a lot of chairs that evening.
I can imagine. I'm sitting here listening to it. That's just really amazing. Now, what would you attribute your success to? I mean, there's a lot of open source projects that, and even you mentioned Whitebox Linux. So where did CentOS do the right thing here?
I think focus was a big deal. What we were creating, we knew what we were doing. We knew how we were going to create a sort of support model. It was very important that we focused on binary compatibility with the Red Hat platform, which allowed our users to inherit a lot of the work that Red Hat was doing and contributing to the open source world. Also focusing on things like, you know, we try and make sure that all of our support avenues are built up around actually educating users. You know, I think I mentioned this in the past as well. It's about, you know, teach a man to fish rather than, you know, spoon feed him to obesity. And I think those specific things contributed a lot in the initial days to get traction. A lot of new sysadmins who were getting into the business found that CentOS was a great place to hang out and learn with everybody. A lot of people who were getting involved with emerging technologies, you know, when they needed a platform that they could take and change just that one thing that they were working on and know that the rest of the platform is going to stay intact. It's not going to change. It's not going to fall around them. And they knew that the guys who were backing it up represented a similar mindset. They came from the user communities. It helped us get traction with a lot of the developing technologies. And when you know, sort of they've come into market, they've taken CentOS with them. I know I've seen a Citrix guy walk in with a demo, and I've seen him boot up a CentOS VM to demonstrate what they're selling as a product. And that was quite flattering, actually.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds excellent. I mean, it's definitely an amazingly successful project. But I was really intrigued by the fact that you said that the core developer team is so small. And I've heard that it's quite hard. There's quite a high hurdle to get over to kind of get in. So can you tell us a little bit why that is? I mean, what kind of skills do people need to get involved? And do you try and maintain a high quality in the people that you do allow into the core team, if you like?
Absolutely. One of the things that has happened, one of the fallouts of, you know, the rapid expansion, or rather the size and the user base that we've got, is that we're very aware of the fact that there is a trust issue. You know, people use CentOS in the hundreds and thousands because they trust the product that is going out. So what happens is that if I, Karanbir, is doing the updates for CentOS 5, then there needs to be a level of trust built between the user base and my name and my identity. What that the fallout from there is that it becomes hard for somebody who's not publicly visible in the community, somebody who hasn't been in the mailing list for a long time, somebody who hasn't helped in the forum, somebody who isn't, you know, known in the admin and the infrastructure communities to be somebody of a particular trust level, then it becomes hard for those people to get involved, which is why we've had to move pretty much into a model where getting into the inner team, for the lack of any other term, or maybe the core team, is a completely invite-only model. So we look at people who are visible in the communities right now, people who are doing a lot of work in the communities, and we try and match them up with skill sets that we find we're short on at the moment. And we work on a completely on an invite-only kind of a basis.
Mm. So how can, if people are interested in getting involved, what's the best way for them to begin on that road, if you like?
Be visible, be okay. Known in the communities, be known, create a reputation for yourself as somebody who understands the platform, somebody who understands the ethos behind CentOS, somebody who understands the relationship between CentOS and Red Hat, and somebody who can contribute on the outside. Now, you don't actually have to be a part of the core team to be able to make a difference. Things like, you know, helping out people is something that anybody could do on the list and the mailing lists. If there's a bug in a package, anybody can submit a patch for it. And we always make sure that we give credit to the person who's done the heavy lifting.
Mm. Excellent. I mean, and as a CentOS user myself, I have to ask you the question that I know every CentOS fan's burning to ask you right now, which is Red Hat 6 has just come out, Red Hat Enterprise 6. So how long do you think it'll take you to get CentOS 6 ready to ship?
Yes, that's the most asked question these days. I think I probably maybe two dozen times every day. So we don't have a release date for CentOS for 6. And it's not that we're trying to be like Red Hat. You know, somebody told me on IRC the other day, you know, why am I trying to be difficult, or why are we trying to be difficult? And Red Hat have their own reasons as to why they don't have a release date that they make public. They have a release date which is internal, but they don't make it public for whatever business reasons, commercial reasons. We have none of those. But what we do have is that we have to make sure that the product works. in our ecosystem, in our environment, with our Meta network. And we have to make sure that we get the branding issues resolved. We have to make sure we get the Red Hat network issues and sort of sorted out. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that the actual distribution that we put out will still adhere to all of the documentation that is available. So as we work through these stages, what we try and do is we try and document it publicly so people can keep a track of what's going on. But we don't really have a release date. If people need something to plan against, if people need to look at a schedule and talk to the boss to see when they can schedule updates or upgrades, or if people need a place when they can expect to start testing CentOS 6, then we usually say that between 4 to 6 weeks from release of upstream, so from Red Hat's release, we should have a product that you can deploy in your environment.
Mm-hmm. Very impressive. Once again, it's just on a lighter note, just to kind of start wrapping up here. Were you around for the Tuttle, Oklahoma incident, and can you describe what that was?
I was, yes. Although it was Johnny who basically did all of the conversation and the communication, I think it was a classic case of somebody who thought he understood technology, but he refused to accept that what he was seeing was what he was seeing. He kept, blaming us for hijacking his machine and, causing damage, and he threatened to call, the FBI on us or whatever.
tell the whole story. Whereas, maybe nobody's familiar with it. It's good.
Actually, it's interesting because, let's look at it in a slightly wider perspective, because Tuttle was one incident. Whereas what actually happens is we get this situation every day. Really? And I'll tell you what happens. When you install CentOS and you install a web server, it by default gives you a screen that says, it gives you a web page as the default home page that says, welcome to CentOS. Your machine is now working. Your web server is now working. And if you now want to start putting your website on, this is what you do. Now, what happens is that as there are security or bug fix issues for the web server, we keep releasing our packages again. And unless people have taken care to remove that default message, it will keep coming up again. So you could install CentOS today. You could put your website in place. But unless you've handled that one situation properly, every time you do an update, you'll get that welcome to CentOS screen again. and we get emails from people who say things like, what have you done to my website? I'm losing business. I'm doing this. And we always have to keep explaining to them that, look, we only provide you the platform. We're not your provider. We're not your, your business associate. We have nothing to do with your website. We haven't hijacked you. We're not spammers. If you want to speak to somebody, I'm happy to speak to you. Drop in on IRC and we'll help you solve the problem or whatever. And we get maybe at least a couple of dozen such requests every week. Wow. And of course, Tuttle is now known as, it became famous, right? It was a city where their website got taken down and there was a lot of hoo-ha about it. But there's certain other things that also come up. Like we had somebody the other day email us that, what have you done with my Facebook? And there were three of us sitting on the computer saying, what have you done to his Facebook? I mean, what's he on about? So we emailed him back saying, explain what's going on. And he said, no, I was in my Facebook account and suddenly I get this welcome to CentOS. Why have you hijacked it? Are you, trying to fish for my passwords? Are you trying to hijack something? And we couldn't figure out what was going on. Till such time as we realized that, hey, hang on, Facebook is using CentOS. And this guy accidentally hit a machine which was still being updated or being upgraded. And he'd actually seen the welcome to CentOS screen in his Facebook session. And he thought that we had hijacked his machine.
Wow. Which was quite funny. Facebook, you didn't realize before that Facebook was using CentOS?
We didn't know at that time. No. We, of course, after that, we tried to get in touch with Facebook to see, what they're doing and how they're doing it. And we were told that, there's like tens of thousands of machines at Facebook running CentOS.
Wow. That's really a testament to the work that you guys are doing. I'm impressed that, what you've done here with CentOS is really make a real, stable, commercially usable platform for Linux.
Sure. I mean, and thanks for that. I mean, we never knew, when we started off how successful it would be. But I think we're all happy that, we've been able to contribute to other people's businesses and even to what they do with machines. There are lots of people who sort of email in, for example. I think there's a government initiative in Brazil who are using some of the work that we do to build a platform for schools. Which we think is fantastic because, again, it's, you know, they say that if you deploy an application on it today, which lets teachers do something, we know that for the next 5 years, we won't have to re-engineer it, which is a massive win for them because it's just so much lower cost for them to run something like that.
And how suitable is this for desktop? Is it just a server distribution or is it also usable for desktop?
It depends. I mean, I use it on my desktop. I use it everywhere. I guess I have no reason not to. But if you're looking for the latest and the greatest features, if you're looking for the snazziest, you know, graphics, you want all the whiz-bang features of, you know, things flying around and all of that stuff, perhaps CentOS is not for you. But if you want a platform that or a machine that you can install today, get your work going on it and know that your work is going to carry on doing what it needs to do. You know your word processor is doing something today. It's not going to break on you tomorrow. It's not going to break on you in 6 months or a year from now. Mm-hmm. Then CentOS makes for a fantastic workstation as well.
That's great. And I have one final question that I've actually been lax in asking for the last 5 or 6 shows. VI or Emacs?
Ooh, definitely VI for me. Definitely VI.
Okay. All right, one for the other guys then. Perl or Python? Perl or Python?
Would I be sort of stretching out a bit if I was to say Ruby?
Ruby's fine. That's an ignoring fair answer. Mm-hmm. Ruby's the prototype for Perl 6, so we're happy. All right. Yeah. Have I left anything out? Anything else you wanted to tell our audience before we let you go?
Well, just that. Thanks for having me on the show. It's been a great experience. I know I've been watching the show as well for a while, and I've learned a lot. For like what you just mentioned about Perl 6, and I never knew that Perl 6 might actually happen till such time as I actually saw the show.
For the information, the CentOS.org, right?
That's right. So our main website is at www.centos.org. But if you just search for CentOS, you should be able to find a fair few resources. We have an IRC channel at #CentOS on Freenode, which is mostly quite user-friendly. Drop in, say hi. And one thing I definitely want to tell everybody is that if they have issues, if they have problems that they'd like to see solved in different ways, if they think there are changes that they'd like to see in CentOS, don't hold back. Just let us know. Because while we are true to upstream, there are avenues for us to change things without impacting the main distribution, and we'd really like to see those avenues grow. I think a lot of people tend to hold back thinking that, hey, you know, CentOS does Red Hat's product and nothing else, which is true for the core distribution. But we do have avenues of doing other things differently. So if there are things that people think that we should be doing differently or doing in a better way or maybe not doing at all, then just reach out. Definitely let us know.
Well, I really appreciate your time, KB. I've been really enlightened now, and now I know why most of my clients are using CentOS, because it really works. Works the way people want to do. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Very good. So that was KB Singh, who is the one of the lead developers for the CentOS project. Been with it for a while, sounds like. So pretty interesting, huh, Dan?
Yeah, really interesting. And as you mentioned, I'm sure you see this a lot more than I do in the corporate world with your clients, but there's so many people running CentOS now. It's everywhere. You know, it just turns up all over the place. It's a real success story, I think, for open source.
Clearly. I mean, obviously Red Hat got the ball rolling by taking Linux and really commercializing it, but it's nice to see that even though they got the ball started and made a lot of money doing that, still continue to make a lot of money. I mean, the two clients that I had that were actually still using Red Hat Enterprise Linux were doing it because they wanted to be able to count on some sort of 24/7, 4-hour response time from a company. And obviously with CentOS, you can't count on that because it's a volunteer support, but sounds like the support channels for CentOS are pretty well developed.
Yeah, the community support's great. And one of the things I mentioned in the interview there from talking to the Red Hat guys is that they actually see CentOS as a kind of a partner in what they're doing. And you can very easily migrate from a CentOS install, go and buy yourself a Red Hat support certificate if you want, and they will come in and they have no problem with saying, okay, you've got a CentOS thing. As KB was saying, swap 3 packages and they're good to go. So yeah, it's a really good starting point for a lot of people.
Very cool. And I appreciate, Dan, you have a lot more Linux knowledge than I do, so I'm glad you stepped in there and asked a lot more heavy questions that I wouldn't have had any clue about Linux. You know, as I've said before, I'm a free BSD guy and OpenBSD guy, and I run OS 10 on my desktop, and so Linux isn't really in my purview very well. So thank you for coming on today's show and helping me out with that.
No problem.
Very good. So speaking of coming on the show, let me look at the upcoming guests, as I always like to write about here. Look, wasn't that such a smooth transition? That was a great transition. That's got to be a good one there. Okay, so next week we have... John Abbey, who's going to talk to us about Ganymede, which is a way of deploying network directory services like NIS, DNS, NetInfo, LDAP, and stuff in a way that's across cross-platform and cross-organization layers, which can be sort of fun. I've got Aaron Newcomb coming back to co-host that with me. Coming up right after that, shortly after that, I should say, is Thomas Garand, who's going to talk to us about GPL Host, which is a deployment platform, a provisioning system. So we've talked about a few of these before, but I think he's got another take on it that looks like it's going to be pretty interesting. And then the show I'm really looking forward to doing, not that I'm not looking forward to the other ones, we've got David Ankers and James Cotton coming to us from Down Under, New Zealand, talking about OpenPilot, which is the open UAV platform, unattended aerial vehicles. So unmanned, not unattended, because unattended would be the, there it goes. No, unmanned aerial vehicles.
Yeah.
So that'll be fun.
Autonomous, maybe.
Maybe a ton of, yeah, something. It's UAV means something. Go look it up. It's in the Wikipedia somewhere. Right? And then Mark Laporte rounding out the year with us, talking about TikiWiki, which is yet another content management system. It started as a wiki, then a lot of stuff thrown into it, as often happens, but it can do all sorts of groupware stuff now. So we're looking forward to all of those. A lot of other people on the shortlist, twitch.tv/floss, has a link to my spreadsheet, which shows my upcoming guests. If you know of a project that should be on that list and isn't yet, have the project leader email me and I'll put them on the short list to get onto there. We've got about 30 items already on the very short list, and now it's just a matter of slotting them in. And as I've often said over the time, I've actually got enough guests here to go floss daily, but I can't take that much time out of my workday to do all of this. It's a lot of fun there. So let's see if that covers most of everyone. Oh, I also wanted to say that if you want to watch us live, you would come on the show. We tape this live every Wednesday morning. Wednesday morning for those of us in the U.S., Pacific time, 9:30 a.m. East Coast time would be 12:30, I guess. And what time is it in metric time there, Dan?
It's 5:30 in the evening.
Okay, so that's pretty easy for you then. It's actually a good slot for you then,
yeah,
right?
It is. Good. It's a great slot.
for both you and Simon, who's also over there often. So that works really nice for you guys. Good deal. Mm. So twit.tv/floss is the show page, but where was I trying to go? Live.twit.tv if you want to watch us live or and come into the chat room. We actually took some of the questions today from the chat room. So if you want to get in and actually get involved with some of the guests that we're talking about, it's a really great opportunity to get your specific questions asked and answered. Also, one more plug for me. You can listen to me recite a science fiction stories. I'm doing a podcast stream for StarshipSofa.com. I've done a couple stories for them already, one a 20-minute one, one a 50-minute one. I love reading, so I'm having a great time chatting with that. And I'm doing a couple more in the queue coming up. And I think that's all I want to plug today. So, follow me on Twitter, Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. Dan, where can people find you and what are you up to?
Yeah, well, I have got a little plug of my own. The big thing that I'm up to at the moment is launching a new website for my band. I play guitar and sing in a band called 20 Pound Sounds that we've just launched our new website, and we're trying to get people to sign up and get involved in the community and stuff. So if people want to do that and go and check it out, it's at 20pound.net, which is 20lb.net. You can laugh at seeing a guy who looks like me sing like Michael Jackson, because I have a rather unusual voice for a guy of my size. Yeah, so go and check that out. Obviously check out Linux Outlaws, which is the weekly show that I do with my co-host Fab about Linux and open source news and all the kind of stuff going on in the open source world. You can find that at linuxoutlaws.com. And then for anything else, if you want to find me on Twitter, the handle is MethodDan, and same for Identica as well, and you can find me at danlynch.org.
Very good, Dan. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. I'm sure we'll have you back shortly in one of the upcoming shows. Appreciate you always coming in there.
No problem. I'll see you soon.
Absolutely, and I'll say to the rest of our audience, what I always end with, we'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.